Welcome to our series on social capital. My name is Tristan Claridge and I'm the director of the Institute for Social Capital. And I'm joined by Lyndon Robison, Emeritus Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. Welcome, Lyndon.
Thank you, Tristan. It's always good to be with you and to have a chance to talk about social capital, and special welcome to others that may be joining us online as well.
And Lyndon and I have both been working on the concept of social capital for a long time, with Lyndon initially approaching it from economics, whereas I came at it from sociology and social theory. We're both very passionate about the concept, and our different backgrounds and perspectives make for interesting conversations and engaging debates. In this episode, we'll discuss relationships, needs and motives and reasons in the context of social capital theory. Lyndon, in the last episode, we discussed how relationships matter, and we've talked about that being central to what social capital is all about. Why do you focus on the importance of relationships in social capital?
Thank you, Tristan. Great question to start our discussion. You mentioned that I started, or my approach to this issue as has been, or my background in economics, and as a agricultural economist, one of the most important question was, how do people allocate their most important resource, which is farmland? And one of the early studies that we looked at was how people determine the selling price for land. That's a very economic question. And the usual solution is, well, there's a supply curve and a demand curve, and then there's a market equilibrium price. But when we surveyed farmland owners in five states and asked them what their minimum sell price was for people with whom they had different relationships, such as a family member, a friend, a neighbor, someone, a business associate, or even someone they didn't like. What was interesting, and I think what changed the way my discipline looked at the farmland market, was that the price varied significantly depending on who they were selling their farmland to. A family member received a substantial discount, 8 or 9%. Someone they disliked, they wouldn't sell unless there was a significant price offered above the market price. So going back, at least in my experience, realizing that the exchange price for farmland depended importantly on who you were selling to and what their relationship was. So from that point, I was no longer able to say in an important market like farmland that there was a supply and a demand curve and that's the end of it.
Yeah, and the whole idea really is that we humans don't just do things for one simple reason out of self-interest, that there may be all sorts of different reasons for our actions, and the nature of our relationships significantly changes the reasons that we have for the actions that we take, whether it be selling our farmland or any number of other things that we may do. So I tend to use the word reasons. And I link it back to the different modes of reason or different modes of rationality that we have, whether it be for, means end forms of rationality, or for other forms that take into account our moral beliefs. I guess you've used the term motives just now, and also needs. How would you put that all together? Like, how would you describe what relationships do, and what sort of language do you use? Because you like to talk about motives and needs.
This is one of the advantages of I have and I enjoy visiting with you is because I appreciate the fact that we often have different words to describe the same concept. And I think that's been a real advantage for me in our conversations over these last couple of years. So the model that I begin with is a description of needs that includes both physical needs that I often label commodities, and then social-emotional needs that respond to our need for internal and external validation, the need to belong, and the need to satisfy altruism desires. And these needs then motivate, I'm going to use the word motivate, to do things to try and obtain goods that satisfy those needs. And it's interesting that the definition of a need, of a good, is something that satisfies the need. So if it doesn't satisfy a need, then it's not a good. So when we talk about goods and services, we're talking about things that satisfy one of these five basic needs. And then, in an effort to satisfy those needs, we take action, we behave in ways that try and acquire the resources and goods to satisfy those needs. So that's, for me at least, a rough outline of the model that I'm using to try and explain behavior and needs and motives.
And I think on that issue of language, I think a lot of non-economists probably would say, well, a good is like a loaf of bread is a good. And it satisfies a need. It's easy to understand that. And perhaps we don't tend to think of relational goods as being goods, but of course they also satisfy a need, as you explained. And so I think it's important when we're using that terminology to recognize that goods aren't just those physical items that meet our commodity needs, but also those relational goods, as you mentioned. And I think what's particularly interesting from our previous discussions is that you've done a lot of research on this, and you'll use those five needs. And people always relate their actions back to meeting one or more of those five needs. And there aren't others. There aren't six or seven or eight or 10. There's really those five broad categories of needs that you've found from the research that you've done.
So we have, in one form or another, trying to explain different kinds of behavior, have administered this needs and motives survey to thousands of people. And we always begin with these five motives and then ask, are there other motives that we've missed? And what we find is that if they do, on rare occasion, suggest a different need, it's often a version or an instance of one of the five specific needs. And of course, we also know that our relationships can be manifest in a positive way or in a negative way. And a negative version of altruism is antipathy, and but it's still basically, I've internalized well-being. I guess that the other point that I would make is that when we try and acquire the resources to satisfy these needs, for example, if we have a commodity need, we try and accumulate different forms of capital to produce the goods, the commodities to satisfy those. Whereas to satisfy the four social emotional needs for internal and external validation, belonging, and transcendence, we invest in and try and develop another form of capital that we for a long time now call social capital. And so it's that connection that our relationships that are tied to, synonymous with social capital, that are the means by which we produce the relational goods that satisfy our four social emotional needs. So, just as physical capital or man-made capital and other forms of capital are important in the production of commodities, relationships, which we associate with synonymously with social capital, are the means by which we produce relational goods. And
So the key question is, why should we care about this? And this comes back to what you were saying in the beginning, that relationships alter the relative importance of our motives. You know, if you're selling your farm to a friend, then your motives are quite different than perhaps if you're selling to someone who you don't like or just somebody who you don't know. And so that's why we care about this. This is why it's important, because relationships and the ways in which we're connected and the meaning and significance that we attribute to the relationships, to relationships, including the way we're connected to others, it does have a significant role to play in our motives. Or the language that I would use, of course, is to say that it shapes the nature of our reasons.
I think you've identified the really the important point, which is that I can't think of, I mean, to model behavior without accounting for relationships, I can't do it in my personal behavior. I can't think of behavior that I engage in that isn't influenced and determined by relationships and, of course, commodity needs as well. So now we are saying not only are relationships or social capital, the capital that produces relational goods, but the motives for which we seek to acquire these resources vary with our relationships with each other. I mean, and so I think you said in our earlier conversation, it almost seems strange that we need to emphasize the importance of relationships. I mean, I would it just seems obvious to me that that's where we should start, that everyone agrees with relationships, and then focus on how we invest in them, how we change them, and so on.
Yeah, relationships, to me, they're inseparably linked to what it means to be human, to go about our daily lives. And so obviously and clearly it shapes the nature of the reasons we do things, or the nature of motives. But we need a concept like social capital. You know, I've said before that this is really an indictment on modern society, that we would need a concept to emphasize the importance of relationships, and fundamentally to be able to understand how a relationship shapes the nature of our reasons for doing things. But the reason we need the concept, of course, is because neoclassical economic theorizing, particularly, we keep coming back to that, but it doesn't take into account these other reasons or these other motives. And it thinks that everybody treats everybody as if they're going to maximize their own self-interest and utility. And there isn't, like, the research that you've done looking at the motives that people have, like you said, that doesn't fit into a neoclassical model of of human behavior. And so we need a concept like social capital to be able to describe it, to discuss it, to emphasize it, so that we can talk about it, and hopefully we can then start to reprioritize the importance of relationships again. And not that they weren't ever important, but we started to not think about them and not focus on them for some time, until really the 1990s, I suppose, when there was a significant growth in interest in this.
So I think we often begin by assuming away a lot of the complicating conditions so we can focus on simply one aspect. I remember reading a quote in an important economic book that said, we recognize that relationships matter, but when you have end participants and end markets, and it becomes very complicated. And so we will ignore the fact that relationships matter and just assume that our attitude toward each other is indifferent. And maybe there's a justification for that, at least is a first step. And maybe you can say, well, there are things that we can learn from the neoclassical model that at least some version of it treats each other as strangers. But I think what we're trying to do in social capital theory is to expand that and say, well, what does social capital mean? How does it change our reference? And I think one of the main changes that it produces is that if I can internalize your well-being through empathy or trust or sympathy or caring or compassion or any number of ways, at least in the positive direction, then it has to change the way we think about rational behavior or self-seeking behavior. If I don't internalize anyone's well-being, then I act selfishly. I'm only concerned about what I'm feeling, what I'm consuming, externalities that benefit me, and so on. But if I indeed internalize the well-being of others through any number of ways, in fact, it's hard not to be connected to someone once we become acquainted with them, then the definition of self-interest or is not selfishness, although it may include and surely does include selfish interests and impulses and so on. But it allows me to act as though the well-being of others was my own and behave in a social way. And we depend on these kind of much broader definitions of self-interest that include internalizing the well-being of others for all kinds of public actions, such as investing in public goods, minimizing externalities, supporting institutions, caring for disadvantaged. Our society really depends on this much larger motivation, which I call self-interest as opposed to selfishness. So I think one of the things that we can point to in social capital theory, at least as we've tried to promote it, is that it leads to a much more social kind of behavior and incentive than simply one of selfishness.
I think you've made a couple of really important clarifications there. One of those being that selfishness is, to use my language, one of the reasons that we may act in certain ways. But there are other reasons as well for our actions. And that selfishness is different than self-interest, because self-interest can still take into account the meeting of our various needs, not just commodity needs, but also our social emotional needs as well. And that's an important distinction. Like we've been
Yes.
talking now for a couple of years. And in the past, when you've talked about internalizing others' well-being, it hasn't quite seemed right to me. I've thought, well, if I'm accommodating somebody else's needs and the reason I identify is because of social norms, do I really care about that other person? Am I internalizing their well-being in any way? And I wasn't sure that I was. But I think when you described it as you just did, that when you're internalizing others' well-being, it's because you're interrelated. Their well-being and your well-being is connected in some way. And I think that's the very important meaning of when we talk about relationships. We're not just talking about social relationships. We're also the people that you know, our network. We're also talking about those ways that we're interconnected, where our well-being is interconnected. And those things, I think, is where we're talking about internalizing others' well-being. That's what we mean, is that interconnectedness that we get from how we position ourselves within society and how we see ourselves, our sense of identity and belonging and everything else that then affects that. Like, this is the core. That's what social capital is fundamentally all about.
If I could illustrate the point that you just made, is one of the concerns that we have is the pollution of rivers or the degradation of our natural resources. But suppose that I'm have the capacity or the economic benefit of polluting a river, and my income will go up if I don't worry about what I'm doing to the quality of the river. Well, a selfish behavior would say I pollute that river. But suppose I had children and grandchildren that lived downstream and swam in the river and maybe drank water from it or whatever. Because of my relationship with those people downstream, I no longer ignore the consequences that my behavior has on others, even though selfishly I might earn more money by doing it. And so when we produce something, which an economist might refer to as an externalities, something that produces a benefit or a cost on others without their permission, the one thing, the important thing that social capital does is it internalizes the well-being of those, or at least it can, and internalizes the externality. For example, the person with the factory on the river no longer views polluting the river as an externality because of those influence downstream. So society, in effect, requires that we develop social capital to avoid or reduce the production of externalities. And so, if you look at the kind of behavior, and now focusing on those motives, what kind of behaviors are encouraged by social capital as opposed to those by selfishness? And it's important that for important social goals, they can only be achieved if we have a sufficient social capital resource. I'm traveling with at the moment with a friend who's a lawyer, and I ask him to take the survey that we've repeated thousands of times. And I said, suppose that a stranger comes to you and seeks your legal skill, what would be your motive? And his response was, well, I get paid for doing that. That's my motive. But I said, suppose that someone from your social group, say from your church or family or so on, and they came to you for legal advice, what would your motive be? Well, zero for money. It would be, it's the right thing to do. I care about their well-being. I want to gain approval of important others. So I guess, and we've said repeatedly on our podcast, relationships matter. And I think what I think we're trying to state today is they matter because we only get pro-social behavior in the presence of social capital motives. And this, I think, challenges sort of a fundamental statement that many attribute to Adam Smith, that people seeking their selfish interests promote the benefits of all. And that simply could be challenged because a bank robber is probably seeking his or her own selfish interest, or any number of ways you could promote your selfish interest without producing pro-social behavior. It's when you care about others and internalize their well-being that you can produce behavior that both is consistent with your own personal interests as well as society's.
And this is key. This is exactly what social capital is all about. And it also seems to be something that's quite lacking in the social capital literature, an exploration of the reasons why relationships matter, the re exactly what is it that social capital actually does? How does it function? How does it shape the nature of our actions in ways that can produce pro-social outcomes? And like your work is perhaps not the only work, but it stands out to me as work that is concerned with those reasons and developing that theoretical foundation for why it is that relationships matter and what it is that they actually do, how it actually functions. And I think it's something that we need a great deal more of in the literature, and it's something that we're advocating for, we're talking about, and we're working on through this podcast and other things that we're doing. Because if we don't have an understanding of those reasons or those motives or the processes that create the pro-social outcomes, then we're not able to influence outcomes for more positive outcomes. We're kind of just guessing about how these actually function. If we get some people together and they form an association, or if people know a few more people and have a bigger social network, then we're going to we assume then we're going to get pro-social outcomes. And while we often do, we don't necessarily. And we do need to understand these processes and mechanisms that create those outcomes. And that's what we're talking about right now.
So, behind relationships, we've talked about, well, what is it that leads to a relationship? And in the past, we've talked about commonalities, things that we share, which we acquire through our choice or earn or inherit. And if relationships are so critical and they allocate resources and benefits or costs, then how relationships form also have to be extremely important. Therefore, we need to look at which commonalities are helpful and which commonalities actually isolate groups or individuals, separate them from the advantages of other groups, and leads us to another discussion of discrimination and institutions that benefit some groups and others. And also the antisocial ways of building relationships, because while we emphasize in social capital the importance of relationships of sympathy and empathy and caring and so on, there are also strong relationships that have formed, and we have lots of examples where the commonality is shared antipathy or envy or whatever the other alternative is for building a relationship. And we have to worry about, well, are we building the right kind of relationships that produce pro-social behavior? Or are there ways that are building relationships that don't necessarily have a pro-social outcome?
And I talk about the
So,
difference between coercion and consent as well, that we can form relationships that are based on coercion, but they don't tend to produce the kinds of pro-social outcomes that we're perhaps interested in. But if we're seeking consent and agreement with others, then we're more likely to get those sort of positive pro-social actions that we're interested in.
So, yes, I guess we're back to where we started, Tristan. Relationships really do matter, and because even though we don't, we have a hard time finding agreement, or at least we haven't been very successful yet on defining precisely what social capital is, I think at least we can say it has to do with relationships. There may be some ways to develop the social capital concept, but it has to have at its core relationships. And of course, I found it very helpful to be whatever internalizes each other's well-being, but that leaves some freedom for discussion.
I think if people can understand what we mean by that, then that's a good way to think about it. But perhaps that's a really good place for us to finish this episode. That's such a big topic for us to discuss. I look forward
Yeah.
to the next episode.
Thank you, Tristan. Always good to see you. And thank you to those that have joined us for our podcast today.
Thanks, London. See you next time.